Hello everyone and welcome to the second episode of Dreams, Memes, Veggie Supremes. I'm Ben.
I'm Jack.
And so, we're probably last time we'll do that introduction. As always, with these episodes, we'll start with the pizza. So, Tobey Maguire from Spider-Man 2, take it away, please.
Thank you.
Pizza time.
So, we're very
do you
sorry.
Want to say the story?
Yeah, here's the story. We're very sorry. We've got Domino's again. We were going to go to a local pizza joint, but they're all open at 5 or 4.30 or
and
even 4.
It's 1 p.m. now.
And it's 1 p.m.
We don't want to wait 4 hours.
Yeah. We have to record the podcast in the evening so that all the pizza shops are open.
Yeah.
But we've changed it up a bit. So now we've got a vegan avocado veg from Domino's. And we've even just treated ourselves to the new, brand new.
Brand new?
Brand new.
Brand spanking new.
Vegan cheesy garlic bread.
So what was it called? Cheesy garlic bread. That's the new thing. Food reviews.
I think we're going to begin with the garlic bread. Although this won't be an official rating. We'll just rate it anyway.
9.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go 9.
9
out of 10. There's not much wrong there, is there? I mean,
it was a bit cold, but I can imagine if it was hot, it would have been...
Yeah.
It was a high rating.
Spring onion. It could have been more. Maybe.
You reckon?
Mm. Because I saw him put it on, it wasn't that much. It's put on after it's not baked. It's not baked in, you know what? Baked in. Whereas the pizza, what do you think?
What did I give the spicy veggie churro? Do you remember?
It was like I believe you gave it a 7. I gave it an 8, I think.
I think it's slightly short of the spicy veggie churro.
So you're going to give it a 7?
I would say it's... I think the... spicy veggie was a 7.5, so I'm going to give that one a 7.
You're going to give that one a 7 as well?
7, yeah.
I'm going to give it a 7. The spicy veggie trio was just a bit more simplistic. This is just, I think the avocado is trying a bit too hard.
Yeah.
You've already got, like, the sloppiness of the cheese, which is nice. Obviously, you need
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the cheese
but
is...
But then the avocado
that's
is like,
still.
As it again. It's like having a big chunk of cheese, almost. Same consistency.
It's interesting, since our main complaint with the spicy veggie was that there weren't enough toppings. And the main complaint with this one is the toppings.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So, one of the things that we got left as a suggestion in the comments of the last podcast was that we do pseudoscience as a topic, which is good, because that's something that we're both interested in having a little bit of a debate in, because both of us... absolutely hate it, let's just say.
It's in our lives pretty much every day, I would say. Especially with my clients, it's always comes up.
Always something that's asked, just about... not always about a lot of them, but there's always just one question or so that's about that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I'll definitely draw on some of my most... essentially, the most pseudoscience I've encountered from my clients.
Yeah, 100%.
I'll draw on some examples from them. But we've got some written down. Obviously, we prepare for these podcasts.
Yeah.
And we've got some topics that we want to cover as well. So we'll get into those.
Should we start off just by saying what pseudoscience is, more or less? So the definition given by Wikipedia for pseudoscience is pseudoscience consists of statements, beliefs, or practices that are claimed to be both scientific and factual, but are incompatible with the scientific method.
Mm.
And do you want to quickly go over what the scientific method is? I think I've got a little chart that you can refer to.
Yeah, there's a lot of different definitions, but essentially
this is the best one that I know of.
Mm. It's the basis of science, and it's the basis of what we do. Up here we've got a diagram that goes into quite a lot of depth. I've looked at 3-stage scientific methods before, and 4-stage and all the rest, but this gives multiple stages. So essentially it's asking a question, so about something in the world, doing background research, constructing a hypothesis, and then testing that hypothesis with an experiment. So then you do that with a procedure, a very detailed procedure that can be replicated and done again, no matter where.
Yeah.
So if it's followed, you'll get the same result, essentially, or similar results. And then you analyse data, and then you draw conclusions from that data.
If the procedure doesn't work, you look into procedure, what could be confounding it, any problems with it, you go back, you try it again with a new procedure. If the results don't align with your hypothesis, then you go back to background research and start looking into other explanations.
Yeah.
So that's essentially what the scientific process is.
And then something that links in with the scientific method and just science in general that's really important is the hierarchy of evidence. And that's essentially just There's good diagrams of it as well for that. Essentially, it's just presented in a pyramid, and at the top of the pyramid, it'll tell you the best and the strongest forms of evidence. So these include systematic reviews and meta-analysis. They're essentially studies that gather other studies together and that have the same procedure, essentially, or are measuring the same variables and present the results collated from all the research. There's constantly systematic reviews are updated. So with big topics, in especially nutrition, you'll see that systematic reviews pretty much come out like every year, every 2 years. And it's the same across other topics as well.
Yep.
And then it essentially goes down to randomized control trials. We won't go into depth with these, but essentially it goes down into randomized control trials, observational studies and cohort studies, which is essentially just a snapshot of the population, like epidemiological evidence. And going down from there, you have case studies, and then you get anecdotes and professional opinion. And that's where it starts to get a bit muddy. And that's where kind of pseudoscience comes in a bit as well, with those lower forms of evidence.
That's its forte more than anything.
Yes.
Anecdotes, or a number of anecdotes, which aren't properly structured within the scientific method. And that's when an idea can become a bit dangerous, in fact, if you've got a lot of people with anecdotes
who
believe it.
That's it. And the core problem with an anecdote is that they actually haven't been through the appropriate procedure to test if that is. So, for example, I say I'm celiac. What are you basing that upon? You're basing that upon essentially a self-experiment. Whether you consciously know that or consciously don't know that, essentially you'll eat gluten and then an hour later you'll feel unwell. Like you eat pasta or you eat bread and an hour later you'll feel unwell.
Yeah.
And you'll draw the conclusion. You're using the scientific method there, but poorly.
Yeah.
And then you'll draw the conclusion that you're celiac, but it actually wasn't. It was actually something else that you might have been consuming, and that's the issue there. It's not controlled.
Issue of placebos.
Yes, there's so many things going on there.
Yeah.
Which is why anecdotes are such a problem.
Yeah, and why systematic reviews and meta-analyses are so powerful, because they almost eliminate those completely.
Mm. Especially if you've got a well-written systematic review in which can highlight the limitations really well. That also just helps the research going forward, because those limitations can gradually be reduced with systematic reviews and meta-analyses and all the rest. Yeah. Essentially, as research goes on, you just start getting a bigger picture of what is the truth around this topic.
Mm. So the biggest thing about true scientific method, and the thing that separates it from a lot of pseudoscience and anecdotes, is that you can prove it wrong. So all science that follows the scientific method should be falsifiable, meaning that someone could prove your conclusion wrong given the right circumstance, given that you are in fact wrong. So a good example of that would be if I find out that through my experiment that, let's use your example, that Ben's a celiac, someone else should be able to come along and prove that you're not one. I can't just say, no, there's no way to prove this wrong, you just are. It's the whole thing with, what's it called, is it Russell's teapot?
I believe so, yeah. I was just going to draw a similarity there to religion. That's one of the problems.
I was going with the
existence. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. With the existence
It's the difference between evidence-based argument and faith-based argument, essentially. I could go, there's a teapot floating around Saturn or whatever. Can you disprove it? The fact that you can't disprove it doesn't mean that it's right. The fact that I can't prove it is the thing that makes it untrue at that point. There could well be a teapot there, but until I prove it, it's not a fact, according to science anyway.
Which is the burden of proof.
Yeah.
And that's something I feel like I'm increasingly trying to explain to people, especially in social spaces and on social media with what we do. A lot of people seem to have this issue with the burden of proof. And they'll make a claim.
Oh, do you want to use some of your examples from nutrition, talking about nutrition in the vegan groups especially?
They're
always the fun ones to see.
Yeah, that's what I'm on about. Like these social spaces like the vegan groups on Facebook and other groups on Facebook and just other places where we operate under Mode of Fitness and Nutrition, and even in our personal lives. Essentially, they'll make a claim and then they'll expect you to have a counterclaim.
Yeah.
But then you just ask for their source for their claim and they can't provide it. And then they get annoyed because you can't provide a counterclaim or a counter-argument. But you don't need to provide a counterclaim or a counter-argument if you can't even cite the source of where you're getting this information from.
Yeah.
Because that means you can just make any bold statement about anything.
You assume something's wrong unless you can support it, essentially. That's the baseline of anything. Mm.
And then they're looking for a statistic or a fact from you that you can cite. But you don't need to. You're not obliged to. They're obliged to find the source of evidence, or obviously credible source. And even if it's not credible, and that's when you pointed out, this source isn't credible that you've given me.
It's based on anecdotes, or it's from a very biased website, say, or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. And then you just test the steps of the scientific method with that piece of evidence. Mm. And that's what you should always do. The reason why this is a really good podcast is because this is going to branch off to lots of other topics that we want to speak about.
Yeah.
One of which being digital health. It's more of a subtopic, really. But yeah, leaving that, just to draw on that a tiny bit. Essentially, digital health is giving this a platform because you've got professionals online who are making these bold claims with no big evidence, and then they're being used as sources. So, big one, Dr. Mercola.
We'll get back to a few of those later, I think, especially with the anti-vaccines.
Yeah, definitely. You've got like Dr. Mercola and all these big...
Dr. Watson, there's a few others.
Atkins, so many. It's actually just quacks.
One more thing that I want to quickly go over, which is it's called Mertonian Norms of Science. So essentially... Forgotten his first name, but Dr. Merton came up with what he believed were things that categorized what true science is and separates it from pseudoscience. So you need originality. So it must present something new to the scientific community. You've got detachment. So the scientist's reasons for practicing the science must be simply for the expansion of knowledge rather than, say, personal reasons or financial gain. Universality. Yeah. So no person should be able to more easily obtain the information of a test than another person. So social class, religion, ethnicity, no factor should be a factor in someone's ability to receive science. Skepticism. So scientific facts can in no way be based upon faith, like we've already spoken about, so falsifiable. Every case, you should constantly check for errors. You should constantly doubt your own results.
Mm.
If, say, like I'm probably going to do an honours and a PhD going forward, I'm going to have to look at my data and go back and try and prove myself wrong. I can't just go, okay, I've got my data, it supports my hypothesis, awesome. I need to try and prove myself wrong. And if I can't, then I can say that's probably a scientific fact.
Mm. That's always an awesome outlook to have on science, and looking into any topic is always looking to prove yourself wrong. And that's something I've definitely done with the last topic that we covered of veganism. I felt that such an extreme change needed extreme reasons behind it. And it did. Because it is an extreme change to what we're used to in society. I mean, more and more every year, it's not becoming an extreme change. Anyway, without going down the rabbit hole of veganism.
we've already covered that to some length. We might do more at a later point, but not today.
But essentially... I was just trying to, for a whole year or two, and still to this day, obviously, trying to find holes in what I believe in.
Mm.
And trying to
trying to find holes in what you believed in as well. I was coming at him every day, just asking him new questions. What do you think about, say, how do you get this vitamin? Or what about this argument? What about so and so? And that's how you should approach things like that.
Mm.
And the last one of the norms is public accessibility. So any scientific knowledge that one obtains and is published should be made available to everybody and within the scientific community.
Yeah, that's funny, because you've got so many paid studies.
Yeah.
you only need $60 for a free day access.
It's available to everyone,
yeah,
but some of them you have to pay for.
Yeah.
Anyone can buy it more so what that means.
And it's such a shame that the access to science isn't everywhere, even though, you know...
More government funding, please.
Yeah, that too, and just like, even with the internet, like only, I forgot the stat, but I believe it's around 60% of the world's population has internet, or is without internet. Remember the
I think it has internet.
Yeah.
I believe it's like more than don't now, which is good.
Yeah, that is good. But 40% still not having an internet, like, I don't know what my life would be like without the internet, it's crazy.
Just look back 30 years or so.
I know, it's just 30 years, it's crazy. Like, Like we said in the last podcast as well, the spread of information now with the introduction of the internet cannot be stopped. And so that's mostly a net positive thing. I mean, obviously there's holes in it, which so we're going to cover one today, which is pseudoscience. I mean, the internet's allowed pseudoscience to spread as well as awesome science that helps people in every area.
Quite easy to say a lot of pseudoscience stuff wouldn't spread quite as well without the ability to instantly tell people about things on an even platform.
Yeah.
Shall we hop into some examples of pseudoscience?
Let's get into some examples. Yeah. I'm apologise if I get quite pig-headed about these, but some of them are quite laughable. I mean, it sounds like
we might giggle a little bit, but that's only if it's properly ridiculous.
Yeah, and a lot of them are.
All right. So, first one up, alternative medicine. Do you want to go into a little bit of what that is?
Yeah, essentially it's just anything that's providing treatment for certain conditions or diseases that are alternative to the conventional. Typically the conventional medicine is based in evidence, especially nowadays. You know, we're not just passing over cyanide over the counter anymore for whatever, or arsenic over the counter for whatever.
Doctors and stuff like that.
Yeah. So alternative medicine includes a lot of CAMs. They're called CAMs, complementary alternative medicines. And they're essentially...
Have you seen... some people call them scams, so-called.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really
good.
Good
little pun.
Yeah, that's good. So, like, herbal medicines. I can't really think of many now, but essentially they're just, like, things that have been used in Chinese medicine or
more extreme
used.
Ones are ones like tiger claw and rhino horn and stuff like that. Ground up, have it in a drink, and cancer or something like that.
Yeah, and you know what I've just realised? It's actually an appeal to tradition. Mm. Like, that's the only basis of their... The whole basis of those kind of CAMs are just purely based on appeal to tradition, which is obviously a fallacy. So basing on, they've used this for thousands of years, so that means we use it now. Like, that makes no sense. If it hasn't worked for thousands of years, it's not going to work now.
Mm. My biggest issue with pseudoscience, especially within medicine, which is what we're going to mostly be talking about today, there's like all flat earth and climate change denial and stuff like that, but we are particularly interested in the health. Because, well, like that example, if you've got someone with cancer, they're desperate, essentially, to cure themselves. They will probably listen to just about any advice that they can get.
Definitely, yeah.
And it's just taking advantage of that, and that's what really starts to make my blood boil sometimes.
Taking advantage of the people that are desperate.
Yeah.
Definitely. And there's money to be made. Obviously, a lot of underlying thing here is money. And it's funny because... that a lot of the time, that's what the people who are advocates for alternative medicine and CAMs and all the rest of these things I'm going to speak about.
Yeah.
They're advocates because it goes against the norm and they use financial influence as like a point.
Yeah.
Whereas like that should never be a point as long as it's not being done in an unethical way. Like in America with the EpiPen recently. Not recently, I think it was a few years ago now actually. How they raised the price of the EpiPen by 600% or something like that. Obviously, if it's not being... unethically used. I mean, in Australia, we're so lucky. We've got we've got the public health care, but we've got the reduction in medicines. I've totally forgot what it's called.
I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, but essentially, we've got a significant government subsidy on medication. So we're very lucky in Australia for that. Anyway, getting a bit off track there. These medicines, the only merit is based on scientific evidence. And people lose sight of that. They'll draw upon other reasons like, you're going to believe in the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, you're going to believe in FSENS, like the Food Standards Australia.
You're going to believe in all those different reviews that people have done.
Yeah, they're just in it for the money. And it turns into a conspiracy theory. Like, it turns into pseudoscience wrapped in a conspiracy theory.
When you start thinking that science is being used as a tool against you, then that's when it can get dangerous because you won't believe any form of logical evidence.
And that's all it should be based on. Just evidence. Simple as that.
What I was going to say is a lot of people would probably think that the use of alternative medicine is quite a small population. Mm. But I was looking for some stats before for the podcast. 1/3 of US citizens use alternate medicines at one point in time. Mm. So it's not just a small fraction of the population.
Yeah. No, it's quite a large chunk. Mm. And even if you just go into... pharmacy and just go down the aisle a bit, there's so much stuff in there.
Yeah.
Like, even just, I mean, I haven't got a big deal with this, but like chlorophyll, and also like chlorophyll.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's classified as a CAM, but it's just essentially a product that's got unsubstantiated claims, and it's being sold for under those claims. So yeah. People who are looking at for weight loss, like, oh yeah, I'll pick up some chlorophyll to lose some weight. You know, it's just like, it's ridiculous. We've got another cam called St. John's Wort. I just thought I'd use this example because this is something I learned in one of my nutrition topics. Essentially, it interrupts with
it's
one
a
of
herb,
the...
It's a herb, isn't it?
I'm fairly sure, yeah. It's a plant. It's a herb plant, I'm not sure. Essentially, it's just a plant product that's sold as a medicine. And it actually interferes with the main drug metabolizing enzyme. I can't remember what it's called. It's like CYP3A14 or something like that. Something really long and hard to remember. But essentially, it's involved in like the majority of metabolism of all drugs. Like 80% of them. In some way, shape or form, it's involved in the metabolism. So having St. John's Wort alongside important medicines that actually have evidence behind them and actually work can interrupt with administering those drugs that actually work. So there's an example of it actually having potentially harmful effects.
Naturopathy. Do you want to... Because that's something dear to your heart.
Yeah, it's very dear to my heart just because of how much I've encountered it in my practice. Pretty much like, I'd say 50% of all my clients before they've come to me have seen a naturopath. I hope I'm not coming up on Google when they type in naturopath. I don't know what's going on.
Do you want to briefly say what a naturopath is?
Yeah, so, I mean, we were just trying to boil it down before the podcast.
It's a very broad and...
It's so broad. The best way I would put it is essentially they work with lifestyle changes to help people with diseases and conditions and just their general health. But a lot of it is grounded in appeal to nature. And appeal to nature is yet again another fallacy in which they say if it's natural, it's good. So if X is natural, that means X is good. If they've got their fingers in nutrition, they've got it in meditation, they've got it in
some degree of
Eastern
exercise.
Medicine. Yeah, some degree of exercise. So they've got it everywhere. Every lifestyle thing.
Which, on the surface, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds like a holistic approach, like we try.
Nutrition, sleep, just encompassing everything to live a healthy life. At one end, it is quite good. Some people can benefit from a naturopath if the naturopath is basing themselves in evidence. But naturopathy was founded under the idea of vitalism, which is the idea that there's some distinct energy within all human beings and to some extent all life, and which is a faith-based claim once again, and unproven thus far, and I doubt it will be proven. And it's just that kind of stuff at the other end of the spectrum where you start talking about chakras and healing, and you need to put a crystal in your room and you'll sleep better and that kind of stuff.
And the way I actually see naturopaths is on a scale from that kind of scale to the naturopaths that will try and administer you food and other things to activate or cleanse certain chakras. But then you have actually naturopaths on the other end who will operate very evidence-based. And that's why the research around naturopath effectiveness is so mixed. There's actually studies out there to show that it's a good thing and it results in positive client outcomes. But like,
all those people were just doing the same thing that a nutritionist would do.
Yeah, that's what I was literally about to say. They'll just be like, eat more fruits and vegetables. That's one of the best guidelines you can give. I know it sounds like your mother saying it, like eat more fruits and vegetables. But it legitimately is one of the best pieces of advice that a naturopath or any other allied health
that anyone can guess.
And that's, and obviously telling someone to eat fruits and vegetables is only going to be a good thing. And one thing I will add to that point of when naturopaths do give you good advice, like eat more fruits and vegetables, they'll use a claim attached to that that's just totally false. I've actually spoke with a naturopath and she was saying the reason why a carrot in its raw form is better than a beta carotene supplement is because the carrot is natural. It's not because it's natural. It's because it's got all the other vitamins and minerals in there. And then you've got something else in there that's called the synergistic effect of food. And it's when you have multiple nutrients all packaged together, obviously in a natural form like a carrot or just anything else, any other food, whole food, which is the basis of a whole foods diet, which is why it's beneficial, because you've got that ongoing synergistic effect of food. So the fiber will help you digest certain things, and the certain vitamins and minerals in there will aid the absorption of others and all the rest. That's the reason why a lot of multivitamins will just go in your mouth and out through your urine mostly. Not saying multivitamins are completely useless, but I'm saying that they'll mostly be passed through your urine because you have all those other nutrients in there that help that essentially help it to be digested and absorbed better than, say, a pill form. So even when they do have good recommendations, a lot of the time, even those good recommendations will have bad reasonings behind them. So it's natural is not a good reason.
Yeah.
The good reason is that they've got vitamins and minerals in there, or the actual food's been tested via the scientific method to show that it purports some sort of benefit. It's not because it's natural, therefore good.
You can apply the scientific method to that. You can say, falsify the fact that natural is good by simply pointing out a lot of primal behaviours that a lot of, say, cavemen would have had.
That's it.
So fighting between tribes is obviously a bad thing. Cannibalism is obviously a bad thing.
They're all natural. And even a better example of it would be for nutrition, sorry, say it's better. Is it cherry seeds that have the cyanide in?
Yeah.
Cherry seeds are natural. Why don't you eat some cherry seeds? Get your daily dose of cyanide.
Death cap mushrooms, very natural.
Very natural, yeah, death caps.
Nightshade.
You can keep going on.
Just keep going for every animal.
You're going to use appeal to nature when a lion's chasing after you and you're like, oh yeah, he's top of the food chain above me.
That's fair.
It's fair. Appeal to nature, take me away.
Can't fight back with like a gun or something. Guns aren't natural.
No, they're not natural. Guns aren't natural. But then again, because it's got such a loose definition, because you've got such a loose definition around what is natural anyway, you could say anything's natural.
Yeah.
Because what was that gun, like, say you got UV a lion and you're using a gun, that's not natural. The gun was made from natural earth materials. Made with our natural brains that we had. It's just like you could keep going further and further down the rabbit hole.
So, Chiropractic.
This is a good one because even I was kind of sucked in to thinking that chiropractics were pretty legit.
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing in the fitness industry, especially. Mm. A lot of people refer to chiropractic or advocate someone to go to a chiropractor if they're having lower back pain, but there's literally no scientific evidence for it whatsoever.
Wow.
And we've just been learning about the history of it just before this podcast, and there's some pretty interesting stuff in there, to say the least.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
I'll try and find some right now. So chiropractic was founded in the 1890s by a guy called D.D. Palmer, who said that he received it from the other world.
Wow.
Which
the other world
is always a little bit of a red flag, I'd say.
Have you not been to the other world yet?
Pretty sure that Western medicine came from that place as well.
The other world,
And his son was the guy that kind of took it further and kept going with it. So the biggest claim that that it makes is going back to his son B.J. Palmer wrote that chiropractors have found in every disease that is supposed to be contagious a cause within the spine. We will find a subluxation, which is essentially slight twisting of the vertebrae, that corresponds to every type of disease. If we had 100 cases of smallpox...
I love how they use the worst example of smallpox, which is like a viral infection.
If we had 100 cases of smallpox, I can prove to you where in one... You will find that subluxation, and you will find the same conditions in the other 99 people.
Subluxation equals smallpox.
I adjust one and return his functions to normal. There is no contagious disease. There is no infection. There is a cause internal to man that makes his body in a certain spot more or less a breeding ground for microbes. And then, because there are so many, they are classed as the cause. First up, firstly, being written in 1909, poor guy, smallpox has been eradicated, so I guess we're just not getting that certain twisting anymore since vaccines came about.
No one has subluxation anymore.
In that certain vertebrae, in that certain position, unfortunately.
It wasn't vaccines, it was just that we...
We just evolved.
We evolved past subluxation.
We still have it, because we still have other diseases.
Of course, it's just a different place, obviously.
So, essentially, the claim is, this is... Okay, just for a bit of reference, not all chiropractors these days believe that. A lot of people nowadays think that he's a bit of a kook.
Yeah.
But they still believe that spinal alterations can help, especially with lower back pain, which is currently unfounded. It's been quite well noted that chiropractors fall into two categories. So most chiropractors will fall into one of two camps, who are referred to as straights, which are people that believe in what the Palmers said 100%.
Oh, wow. And still those people about?
Now, yeah. They're the minority nowadays, thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully.
But during the early 20th century, they were the majority.
Mm.
Which, you know, that's less than 100 years ago, which is quite shocking, to say the least. And the other group are mixers, who believe in the value of spinal manipulation, but still believe it should be used in combination with conventional medicine, which is a far safer way of doing things, yeah. I would say, but still...
But still dodgy, because they're using the conventional. That's probably what's doing all of the work, majority or all of the work.
Mm.
And then they say, oh yeah, I used like spinal cracking something to help this person. No, you use conventional treatment too.
Mm. And there have been some reports, just I'll mention this before we get some comments, of there being benefits for lower back pain specifically of spinal manipulation, but it's very weak evidence.
Mm.
And until it gets a little bit stronger, you don't really want to be practicing something with that weak evidence.
I mean, have you seen those people? I'm skeptical on this though, because have you seen those really shocking videos where people walk into a chiropractor like hunched over?
I think I've seen the exact same one.
Yeah, and they go in for some cracking sessions, and then they come out like,
Obviously,
that's an anecdote.
Yeah.
Yet again, and there's not rigorous scientific evidence, but it's still very convincing.
You would think that if there were loads of cases like that, the evidence for it would be a lot stronger. What makes it a little bit.
Yeah, exactly right. And then again, it's just like it's the element of truth. Using the element of truth to lure people in to believing this. And there's so many more examples of having that small bit of truth in there, or that case study in there, and then just blowing it out of proportion and saying like, yep, it's legit.
Yeah. And just one final thing I'll say is that spinal manipulation, with the upper spine in particular, has... been known to result in complications leading to permanent disability or perhaps even death. Which, you know, very, very meagre evidence for benefits with the risk of death is always a little bit...
Or permanent disability.
Always a little bit of a...
Good side note, go to an allied health professional, go to a physio who knows what they're doing.
Physio, another thing, physios have a uni degree.
Yeah.
If they're a doctor... then they've done a PhD in physio.
Yeah.
Chiropractors don't have that. Even if they're called a doctor, they've gone to a school of chiropractor.
I don't know how they can get around that, calling themselves a doctor.
Yeah.
A chiropractor.
It's because they don't call themselves a doctor of philosophy, like a PhD does, or a doctor of medicine, like an MD does.
Yeah.
They call themselves a doctor of chiropractic.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, what's the word?
But they still get that...
Chiropractic, sorry. Yeah. Doctor of chiropractic.
But they still get that little...
They still get
the doctor.
That's the killer bit.
So detoxification is another pseudoscience and another one that I encounter almost on a daily basis.
Yeah, me as well, to be honest. Have I told you many of those?
Pretty much everyone. If you get into any conversation with anyone about nutrition, detox almost always comes up, even just like in general.
You'd be surprised how often it comes up with fitness. People saying, since I've started working out, I can feel like I'm sweating out the toxins and
toxins,
stuff like that.
Yeah. Even if you just speak to someone who's had a big weekend... and they're like, yeah, definitely need a detox after this weekend. Mm.
Juice cleanse.
Oh, don't get me started on juice cleanses. We won't go into that. But essentially, detoxification is just people believing that when they eat crap or they drink crap or they just have... Yeah, it's pretty much eat or drink crap.
If they've
they
been eating
toxins,
junk food for a while
without
eating too very healthily, and then they change their lifestyle or their diet or anything like that.
Yeah, they think that toxins accumulate or some other byproducts accumulate or whatever. It's really like just very assumptive. It's a very assumptive base, this one. And it's very popular assumption that this happens, like when you eat junk food or you drink alcohol or whatever, that you have toxins that you need to get out. I mean, and yet again, there's an element of truth here. Like, for example, the reason why you feel hungover the next morning after a big drinking session is because of toxins, and it's because of things that are toxic. You know, things that are toxic are toxins.
So there is an element of truth, but you can't do anything really about that. You just, your body does it for you. So for example, that this kind of leans in with the alkaline diet versus the acidic diet and all that, which is also another pseudoscience area. Your body has the necessary mechanisms to get rid of toxins and to keep your blood pH balanced and all the rest.
Homeostasis.
Yeah, yeah, it's literally homeostasis. You have three ways in which you...
Year 8 biology.
Yeah, it's year 8 biology. You have three ways in which you maintain your blood pH, your blood buffers, you've got renal compensation, and then you've got hyperventilation. They're the three ways that you maintain your blood pH within a very tight area. It's like 7.3 to 7.4, something like that. And yeah, your urine pH has nothing to do with your blood pH, which is what they use, and all the rest. And,
yeah, because your urine pH can be a little bit fluctuating, can't it? Because it's a waste product.
Yeah,
so if you've been eating more acid, you'll be getting rid of more acid.
Yeah, so like with the thing with the acidic proteins, the sulfur-containing proteins like methionine, for example, although there is separate evidence for methionine with cancer and all the rest, yet again, totally different. Yeah, anyway, getting off topic again.
Yeah.
You excrete more of those sulfur-containing amino acids, which are acidic, in your urine, and then your urine's more acidic, and you go, oh, that means my blood must be the same. No, it's not the same. You only have acidic blood if you have legitimate acidosis, which is caused from, like, untreated type 1 diabetes, some other form of kidney failure. It's very, very slim amount of people actually have acidic blood.
Yeah.
That's actually causing problems.
Anything else to say about detox? I don't really have too much to add to that. Ben,
just essentially
Ben
that
pretty
is
much
such
just
a,
covered
yeah.
just about everything.
I mean, it's not, but yet again, it's not really a dangerous thing, which is why I don't have too much, like, quarrel with it, except obviously being untruthful.
It's a waste of money.
It's a waste of money.
That's...
I mean, typically people are implementing healthier things with this belief behind it, so I don't have too much, like, against it. Like, I don't get angry with it. Yeah, I mean, here, colon cleansing, that's where it starts getting a bit annoying for me, because that actually is very dangerous. Like, essentially, they shove water into your anus and just get rid of everything in there. It's not good because you've got all your beneficial bacteria in there. You're getting rid of all of it that's been building up over however many years. All that beneficial bacteria that helps you digest all your food, and essentially your gut microbiome is very linked in with the rest of your body. Some really interesting research about the gut communicating with the brain, and a lot of that is based upon the state of your gut microbiome. That's when it starts getting bad. Whereas people eating fruits and vegetables the next morning after a big session out on the piss, I mean, it's not really a bad thing, is it? We've got two more examples.
Examples we want to cover quickly.
We'll go over them very quickly. We've got anti-vaccine and anti-GMO.
Yep.
Jack.
If you have any value in science, you probably know by now that... That's a good way to start a sentence, because it's essentially the bluntest I can put it. Then you know that vaccines have value. We'll go into the implications slightly later on, but that's essentially all you'll need to say on the topic for this point in time, and then we'll talk about the implications in a moment.
Essentially, people who are against vaccines, specifically within children, vaccinating children, that's a very, very big topic. And Australia are nailing at the moment with the you have to vaccinate your child or you don't get healthcare. Oh, love it.
Yeah,
good job, Australian government. Next one, we'll just breeze past that one because we're going to speak about the implications. But anti-GMOs, Jack, if you want to describe a GMO.
So what a GMO is a genetically modified organism. So it can be a plant, it can be an animal, it can be a bacteria. Just any organism can be genetically modified.
That sounds scary.
So it sounds quite worrying. It sounds like someone in a lab is going to make like a super virus or something like that, which, you know...
Maybe. That would be GMO.
That would be a GMO, and that I would agree with anyone that might be a bad GMO.
Yeah, case by case basis, isn't it?
A piece of a corn plant that produces in more arid conditions, I wouldn't say there's too much harmful in that.
No, that's too scary. I don't want to give people the food and food to people who live in arid conditions. No, they're not worth it.
Yeah. So, essentially, the big fallacy here is going back to what we were saying before about the naturalistic fallacy.
Yeah.
It's the idea that because this corn is slightly engineered or selectively bred, it's somehow bad for you. which is very, very seldom the case.
Mm.
To my knowledge, it isn't the case in any food example as of yet.
Well, sorry, I misunderstood what you said there.
So, have there been any GMOs that have led to actual
deaths?
Yeah, essentially.
No, there's been none that have been linked to a death.
I was going
to
say issues.
I'm not sure about issues because it'd be very hard to track it down. Like, yet again, you couldn't plug that through the scientific method very well.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to say. I know there's some pretty convincing information behind glyphosate, but that's a not even really a GMO. It's kind of like it's related, but it's not a raw GMO. Like,
yeah.
As in for golden rice, for example, which we'll speak about in a bit.
So GMOs typically fall into two main categories as well. You've got stuff that's been selectively bred, like the corn in arid conditions, where you just have a corn plant that can survive in a desert. You put a bunch of corn in a desert, the ones that survive, you breed them.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, those ones can survive in the desert, which ones grow bigger under those conditions?
Mm. And that's
you
happened for thousands ones. Of years.
That's how we have domesticated animals, all these plants. You see, just Google what a watermelon looked like 1,000 years ago or something like that.
I wonder if these anti-GMOers, if they went back in the day and they had a cornfield, they would just grab the bad ones as well to get a good spread. They'd grab the good ones.
It's all natural.
They're pro-GMO in the back of their minds when it comes to selective breeding. Yeah. Anyway.
And the other form of GMO is, I think, the one that more people are worried about because it sounds more invasive, I suppose, which is where you take a section of a genome and you input another species genome in there to select for a favourable trait.
Essentially speeding up the process of selective breeding.
It's the same result as selective breeding, but you're actually targeting a trait more efficiently, more or less.
Mm.
And an example of that would be the golden rice that we'll speak about in more detail in a moment.
Yeah.
But do you want to briefly mention what that is?
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole podcast about GMOs because there's so much that goes into it. One of my favourite movies, Gattaca, is based around kind of like this topic, and that's where it can start crossing over with ethics a lot, especially when you're talking about conscious and sentient beings. But we're talking about it here in the context of food. To go off track there a bit, I just needed to say that. Golden rice is essentially a rice that has been genetically engineered to have vitamin A in there. And this is especially important because there's people in third world countries and other countries where they have malnutrition, especially with vitamin A deficiency, where rice is the main staple of their diet. So genetically engineering a rice that has vitamin A in there in the form of beta carotene, hence the word golden rice, because beta carotene gives off a yellowy orange colour. Like sweet potatoes, carrots. Yeah, exactly right. It would save so many lives. There's estimates going from just like 40,000 in like one country. I think it was like 40,000 in India, and that was in a certain time frame.
Yeah.
And there's other places citing millions, and because there are millions that die from vitamin A deficiency, it's crazy.
Blindness and stuff and I think it's side effects.
500,000 people. I think it may have been just in India who get permanent blindness from vitamin A deficiency. So something like golden rice could save millions of lives.
How do they make that? How do they make the rice produce the...
I'm not entirely sure. I think they've just essentially inserted a gene there that allows it to synthesize beta carotene. I think there is selective breeding going on there in addition to genetic engineering. I'm not entirely sure of the details behind it, but I know for a fact it's safe. The only reason why it's not been released yet is because of pressure from anti-GMO groups. I think Greenpeace have done a lot of that as well, which is a shame to hear from an environmental organisation. Also, I think they've had crop failures as well. But yet again, if there was a big push for a technology, I would call it a technology, like golden rice, then they probably would already be out now, or at least significantly reduce the time it takes to produce it.
Found it. So you've got rice and you simply insert the genes from a daffodil and from a soil bacteria. And then it suddenly has the ability to produce vitamin A.
Beta-carotene. Wow. Well, that's amazing. Yeah. And I think there is, like I said before, there is some selective breeding going on there as well. Obviously to find the best crop that has the best like effectiveness, like yield and all the rest.
Yeah, and they recently started to put another gene in from a maize to essentially make it produce even more beta carotene.
Yeah, and maize is a quite hearty plant, probably help it with surviving as well in the rough conditions. But yeah, something like that. Anti-GMO protesters and if you can call them activists or whatever, you could help hold them accountable for essentially the blindness and death of these children and women, because that's who it affects the most, is children and like pregnant women. Mm. You can hold them accountable in some way. And to think that you being against GMOs is stopping the progression, which is going to lead to innocent children and women being saved from death. Yeah, crazy to me.
I think
where it starts boiling my blood.
One of the big things with it is it's the distrust with companies.
Mm.
So with, say, I understand in the case of some companies, say
Monsanto.
That was the example I was going to use. Monsanto and their gene patenting.
Mm.
That's highly
unethical.
If you haven't looked into it, I highly recommend it, because that's something that is just a really almost evil thing
to
do.
It is evil. It's disgusting. Yeah.
And that's that kind of GMO, 100%, you can see how that would be an issue. Mm. When you have a GMO with the goal of producing more crop, then it's...
That would be a bad thing.
There's no ulterior motive. There's no evil person cackling in their tower.
Exactly right, yeah. In a Monsanto tower. Yeah, essentially, it's a case-by-case basis with these. With everything, it's always a case-by-case basis. And that's why, without getting into politics a bit, like with the left and right of the political spectrum, you essentially automatically subscribe to it with a set of beliefs and ideas that you should subscribe to. That should be eradicated off the face of the planet. And that's just dogmatism. And that's what a lot of these rely on, is dogmatism. And you essentially believing in that set of beliefs, you should always go on a case-by-case basis and challenge your own beliefs.
Yeah, you should be skeptical, but willing to change your mind.
For example, I'm pro GMO.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't... That's not a dogmatic belief of mine.
If
there's a GMO that comes along that's got evidence that actually shows that it's deleterious to people's health, then I'll change my tune on that specific GMO.
I can say broadly I support GMOs.
Exactly, yeah.
I won't say I support, say, the production of a human chimpanzee hybrid, because that might be unethical, let's say.
That's it.
You have to look at it case by case, and mostly through consequentialism. You have to just go, will this be quite harmful? Mm. If it is, probably not the best thing to support. Or will it be beneficial, in which case support it?
Yeah, that's right. And if it does in the process cause a bit of harm, but for essentially a greater outcome, which is a controversial thought and a controversial topic, but a lot with these things, still via consequentialism is the best thing to do. You're going into a bit of utilitarianism there as well, but we won't get into that.
We'll leave a philosophy debate for another time, but...
yeah.
Look at the consequences. If it's a good consequence, support it. If it's a bad one, don't support it.
Yeah.
That's essentially the easiest message said than done.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice segue into the basis of beliefs of pseudoscience, which is what we've got next. So like we said before, dogmatism, but there's other ones that include anecdotes that we've already covered, placebos, we've mentioned that, I think.
Yeah.
And another thing that we've covered a lot is the legitimate basis of these things.
Mm. So it's surprising to say that some aspects of pseudoscience have some kind of legitimate scientific claim which they're based upon, but it's just not followed through to the logical conclusion, or it's not tested further to actually get somewhere worthwhile. You stop too early and you start spreading it, and that's when it becomes pseudoscience rather than science. If you follow it to its conclusion, you get science.
Yeah, that's it.
If you divert and think you have the final solution, then it's pseudoscience.
Mm. I'll use a good example for this, is the soy and estrogen topic. I get that probably equally as much as the detox thing in my practice with my clients.
So many people asking about soy.
Yes, and it keeps coming up now and then. Like, it dies down for a couple of years or a year, and then like everyone's kind of fine with it, and then something else will happen. Recently, or not even that recently, but at the start of this year, there's a famous guy I think he's on the right end of the political spectrum, and he's like a conservative speaker in America. He's an English dude though. Anyway, Paul Joseph Watson, he started the soy boy thing.
Oh, yeah.
And in his correlation...
What a meme.
a massive meme. It essentially was correlating people who just had female mannerisms, like dudes who have female mannerisms.
Just flamboyant guys.
Yeah, flamboyant guys. And he was correlating that with their soy consumption. And then that was his science. And everyone jumped on board with it.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. Like, that was... That's a science that, and everyone's eating it up. Like, this guy's supposed to stand for facts and truths, and does this. Essentially, there is a nugget of truth to this, and I think there's two case studies available that show it. One of the famous one that's always cited was in, I think he was a 19-year-old lad. He had untreated type 1 diabetes and a host of other health issues.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of soy, like a lot. I forgot how much
the equivalent
was. I think
you've told me how much it is.
I think it was like equivalent to 4 blocks of tofu a day. Like 4 blocks, that's 2 kilos.
2 kilos of tofu.
Mm. And he was having that much, so he's an unhealthy guy. And it's funny, the study was like, he's a type 1 diabetic, untreated, and he's got something else, but otherwise healthy. Yeah, otherwise he's healthy, yeah. And then he was eating that much soy, and then he found, obviously, a significant increase in estrogen.
Why was he eating that much soy? Just out of curiosity.
God knows. I think he might have been in an Asian country where they do eat quite a lot of soy, but I actually don't know.
That'd be interesting to look into.
Yeah, I don't know. He could have been someone who was avoiding meat, or who could have been a body. I don't know. Got no clue. But essentially, his estrogen significantly rose, and that was a case study. People would rather take that because it kind of goes in line with what Paul Joseph Watson said, or whoever else said, and they'll take that against the legitimate science that's out there, especially on loads of Asian populations and specifically on men, where their estrogen concentrations and their testosterone concentrations have shown no association. If anything, it actually reduces your estrogen because it acts as the estrogen mopper, because it binds to the same receptor, therefore stopping estrogen coming onto that same receptor. Yeah. So your estrogen doesn't go up as much. It actually does the opposite, which is why we find a preventative role in breast cancer with soy consumption in women and all the rest, and prostate cancer in men. So,
is it true that you essentially get the benefits of estrogen with that, without the negatives of the breast cancer?
Yeah, essentially. Pretty much. Breast cancer is very hormonal-related cancer, and obviously associated with the 3 estrogen hormones. Like I said, it acts as an estrogen mopper, so these women who do have the excess estrogen that might be accelerating cancer growth in their breast, it's going to mop up that excess estrogen by binding to the same receptors, essentially blocking it. And then, because it mimics estrogen, it's called phytoestrogen, plant estrogen. And then, so yeah, the excess estrogen doesn't lead to the deleterious effects that excess normal estrogen would. It's quite crazy. It does the opposite of what people say.
Another quite interesting thing is if you put that the claim of soy feminizing men through the falsifiability, all you have to do is find someone who eats quite a lot of soy and is very masculine, and just a quick Google search of, say, vegan bodybuilders will bring up a big long list of people who feel that pretty easily.
I'd feel bad doing that at the same time, though, because like, that's just not how you should operate within science. It's like the lowest form, lowest tier of evidence possible. But yeah, we've went over a lot. We've went over anecdotes. We haven't gone over placebos too much.
We'll mention placebos now then. So one of the big things that was in science that you have to deal with is the placebo effect, which I'm sure most people are familiar with, which is essentially where you have a group who believes they're, let's use medicine as an example. You might give one group the test pill and another group a sugar pill and not tell them which is which. And you actually find that the group that does the sugar pill will have some form of improvement simply off of the basis that they think they're being treated, which is it's one of the most interesting effects in science. Like, we still don't really fully understand it because it sounds quite counterintuitive. If the body can improve itself, why would it not?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But it's just all down to that more or less willpower type thing. You believe that you're going to get better, so you start to get better.
I mean, because your psychology is very obviously intertwined with, I mean, the biochemical state of your body and vice versa.
A positive mental state will help out with just about anything. Yeah, so if you believe, right. If I gave you a pill and said, this will cure your asthma, you might get less frequent asthma attacks. Mm. I could have just given you a sugar pill.
Mm.
And it's interesting how it works, and it's one of the biggest things that you have to be aware of in science.
Yeah.
Because I could have really bad coughing, let's say. I could have a really sore throat. I put a crystal in the corner of my room, and then I start feeling a lot better. Do I start feeling better because of an effect that the crystal is having on me, or because I believe that the crystal is having an effect on me? And that's why you need to have controlled experiments with the placebo accounted for, lots of replicates, lots of a really big sample size, and then you can find out, oh no, that's just the placebo effect. The crystal is actually not helping.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And that's where you get your, like you said, your double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized control trials. You just keep adding adjectives to these studies, essentially. But
the more adjectives, the stronger the study.
Yeah, the stronger the study, yeah. That's it. We went over dogmatism a bit, and that's just essentially subscribing to a set of beliefs and holding those.
Not compromising from them.
And it's essentially the antithesis of thinking that you should think on a case-by-case basis.
Mm. Placing your belief above evidence, essentially, is another good way to think about it.
Yeah, definitely.
If I believe that autism is caused by vaccines, someone gives me a study, I'll go, no.
Nope.
No, well, what about this study where it is shown that it does in that one study with only 12
No, people? but mercury or something like that.
It's...
Which is a good segue, again, we just keep doing this natural podcasting here, into the implications. So we have three ones that really grind our gears here. Got cancer and alternative medicine, golden rice, we spoke about again. Might just not even touch on
that. Yeah, you went over the golden rice already.
And then anti-vaccine. So,
we were just saying about the anti-vaccines. So I'm just going to get up what I had a moment ago. So the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, estimates that 164,000 people around the world die of measles every year. Just a quick note, measles being a preventable disease with vaccines.
Yep.
But that's besides the point. Whooping cough, which is another disease which could be quite easily prevented with vaccines, causes around 195,000 deaths per year, which preventable.
That's quite a lot.
And while it is true that the majority of the deaths occur in impoverished areas, so third world countries who don't really have access to vaccines, the fact that in developed areas like the UK, Europe, the US, Australia, the fact that they're starting to they're becoming more common in these areas is
concerning.
When they shouldn't exist whatsoever. Mm. That's the big thing. The fact that these diseases are all close to eradication before, I believe it's 1998, the autism study came out, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with. I've got it up here, which, just for a bit of context, it's got a big red watermark with retracted written across it.
Wow.
But
I've never seen that before.
It's a study from 1998 by Dr. Wakefield, who essentially suggested that with 12 people as the sample size, he concluded that autism is correlated with vaccines, at which every study since then just about has disproved.
Mm.
Those that haven't disproved it have found no statistical significance.
Mm.
And it's been found that Dr. Wakefield had some financial investment in finding that conclusion.
Mm. Right.
And yet people will still cite this study over and over despite... It's been retracted from the literature.
Just to give you an idea of what we're looking at on the screen, it has the method and the findings with a massive opaque red retracted text.
The article itself is titled with retracted colon, and then it says the title, which, if that's not a red flag for you not to use said data,
quite literally a red flag.
It's been retracted from the literature.
Yeah.
The journal itself has decided that's not what we value, that's not proper science, that's biased for one, and it's goal-driven towards what he wanted.
Financial bias.
Small sample size, if you look at the...
It's 12 children and 11 boys as well, so that means just meaning that there's just one girl.
A single girl.
It's a side point, I know it's a very minor point, even then.
The sample size is nowhere near big enough financial gain was involved.
Mm. I would not assume saying, poor study design as well. I've not actually read the study, but I'm assuming poor study
design. I've read it. It's a very iffy study.
Yeah. Probably a correlation and causation.
It was correlation.
Yeah.
Just to put that into context as well, the significance of the data wasn't very big. It wasn't a massive significance. So even if we give Dr. Wakefield the benefit of the doubt, which I really don't want to do, but I'm playing devil's advocate. Let's say, just have a little thought experiment, that autism is caused by vaccines. The benefits of vaccines still massively outweigh the risk of autism. The risk of autism would be, even if it did exist, the risk of autism would be very low. Whereas if you got rid of vaccines altogether, the risk of those diseases and death by those diseases of children, which is one of the big things which we haven't emphasized. This is children we're talking about and their parents deciding for them based on their own lack of critical thinking skills. Yeah. I'm going to be completely brutal.
Yeah, it is, but it is brutal essentially. And you're putting other, it's not just like a personal choice. Because you're actually affecting others via the lack of herd immunity. We won't get into that now, but essentially...
The more people who are vaccinated, the more immune the population is.
Yeah.
If there's people who aren't vaccinated, that's a chink in the armour.
Mm.
Other people can then get infected and you've essentially ruined the protection that everyone had.
Yeah, that's it. So that's why I fully support fully vaccinated schools.
Mm.
They shouldn't allow children in who aren't vaccinated.
Yeah.
For those fully vaccinated schools.
When it becomes a danger to other people, it goes beyond personal choice.
It goes beyond personal choice.
If it didn't, then I could personally choose to go and murder someone. All right. So the only thing we really want to finish off on is the implications of alternative medicine. So,
and specifically related to cancer.
Yeah. Luckily for us, perhaps, a study came out just 1 week ago.
1 week.
Looked at the effects of... Well, it essentially had two groups of people. One group was offered alternative medicine in combination with their... what's the word I'm looking for?
Conventional treatment.
Conventional, thank you. So they were offered alternative medicine in combination with their conventional medicine. And the other group just had conventional medicine. And it's quite a disturbing result, you could probably say. So the study found that the people who used alternative medicine exclusively, because you could do that if you wanted, you were at twofold greater risk of death over the study period.
Mm. What was the study period, if you don't mind me asking?
That's a good question. I'll try and find it quickly. So it was a 10-year period.
10 years.
Just about. Or just under, sorry.
No, 10 years.
No, yeah, sorry. Ten years.
Exactly 10 years.
So it was a 10-year period. Right. And over that period, people who used alternative medicine were two times likely to die of the cancer that they were diagnosed with.
Does that say 1,901,815 patients?
I believe it's a glitch.
Seems like a decent sample size, at the least, anyway.
Yeah.
With, over a long period.
So. Where's the thing that I'm looking for? Oh yeah, I've got it now. What they found was that the people who received alternative medicine were more likely to refuse the conventional treatment. The people who had alternative medicine alone were twice as likely to die of the cancer than the conventional. But it's noted that the survival difference could be completely mediated if the people using the alternative medicine also stayed on the conventional medicine.
Which, that's a nice way of saying that the alternative medicine's just trash.
It made zero difference whatsoever.
Yeah, and I mean they've even wrote it in a way that's sensitive to these things. Mm. And one thing I wanted to add in this podcast is that I can get quite frustrated with these, and we shouldn't really tiptoe around people's unsubstantiated and irrational beliefs. Mm. It's the same with religion. I'm not saying be hostile towards these things. Don't be apologetic for shutting these kind of beliefs down. Obviously, don't be a dick about it. But I feel as though people tiptoe around it and it just delays the progression of where we should be going.
Mm.
I feel as though you should just be nice about it, obviously. Just be kind about it. Be candid. But be stern at the same time.
Yeah.
This is not supported by the evidence. you are not doing the right thing here.
Oh, future podcast.
Yeah.
Motive versus religion. I'll quickly go over the numbers given by the study as well, because they're quite shocking. The people who were given alternative medicine, I mentioned they had higher refusal rates for the conventional medicine. The numbers being for surgery, they were 7%. They had 7% refusal rate. They 34% refused chemo, 53% refused radiotherapy, and 33.7% refused hormone therapy. Now, just comparing that with 0.1%, 3.2%, 2.3%, and 2.8% for the group just using conventional medicine, there's a massive difference there. Mm. The fact that people are believing and willing to essentially stake their life on it, that the alternative medicines are going to help them, is a big problem.
Mm.
Especially when you couldn't do the alternative medicine, just be doing the conventional medicine at the same time.
Yeah.
Then you get the benefits of the placebo from the alternative medicine.
That's right.
And you get the
There's not just no use in doing it. If you do it and you believe it hard enough, it might actually have a tiny bit of a benefit.
If you believe. It will have an effect.
One thing I'll add again, that just is related to what I said just before Jack went into a bit more detail around the results, is that I want to be sympathetic as well, because a lot of the time it's just ignorance.
Yeah.
And
it's ignorance or desperation in most of these cases.
Yeah, it's desperation. So I'm more annoyed at the people who are in a position of power and do this.
The people who are selling it. Yeah, 100%.
It's the people who are selling it. It's their fault. Like, a lot of the time, majority of the time, I don't blame the consumer for being ignorant. Like, it's obviously, we implore you to educate yourselves, and that's pretty much what we're doing at Motive as well. A large part of what we're doing is trying to get the best evidence-based information out on fit health and fitness and nutrition and all the rest. That's one of our roles. I mean, we are, without saying pig-headed, in a position of power, because we're presenting information to the general public about health and fitness and nutrition. We have a responsibility to present the evidence-based information.
But what I would say here is, please doubt us. Find counterpoints to what we say, research it, look into it, try see if the evidence falls your way, our way, whichever way, or neither of the ways. Just leave a comment or something, and we'll, if we've got something wrong, say. Yeah. That will mean that we then learn.
Exactly right.
And vice versa, if you put forward some evidence and we go, oh no, but here's the evidence we're using and that's stronger evidence, then only benefit, essentially. No one loses.
Yeah, it takes a very short discussion to realise where the truth lies.
If you've got two rational parties.
Yeah.
Mm.
If you've got two rational parties, it takes a very short discussion to figure out where the truth lies.
Yeah.
Typically, I always have a good saying, the truth's in the middle. And I use that with a lot of issues. It's somewhere in the middle, whether it's towards one end or the other, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because everyone likes to be, like I said before, dogmatic about things. But yeah, like Jack said, challenge power at the same time. Although we are in a position of power presenting information to the general public about health, fitness, and nutrition, we want to be challenged.
Mm.
We implore you to challenge us. So a lot of people don't do it, and now that's one of the issues with power, about having, you know, a provider of something and then having the consumer and picturing them as above. They shouldn't be in a position like that. I mean, the person who's in a position of power and providing you information and whatever, they're there to help you at the end of the day. That's what they're there for, and that's what we're here for as well. We're here to help our clients and help people and help the general public become more literate in health.
It goes back to the...
doesn't mean you should be challenged.
It goes back to the Mattonian norms. You should be able to, everyone has access to the same information, essentially.
Yeah.
Should look up and find out and see. You might find that you disagree with us originally. You look it up with an open mind and then you go, oh, okay, I see where they got that from.
Mm.
Or you might go, wait a second, I found this paper that's more supported than theirs. Oh, it's a recent one. I'll send it to them and then maybe they'll change their mind.
Mm.
And then essentially, everyone has the same access to the information.
Mm.
You just have to be able to read it and discuss it civically and reasonably.
Yeah, that's it. But that's hard to do.
It can be quite challenging.
Yeah,
especially if it's an emotionally charged topic or something that you're...
Yeah, and most of the time they are, which is a shame.
Yeah.
But
shall we cut off here.
Wrap it up. Yeah. Wrap it up. All right, it's a good place to wrap it up.
Mm.
So we've spoken about pseudoscience. We've given some examples. We've spoke about the implications. We've spoke about the underlying belief systems that are in there. So please, if you've got anything to add that we missed or you want to add on to and or challenge us, like we said just then, please let us know. Yeah, we hope you enjoyed the second episode of Dreams, Memes, Dreams, Supremes.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks for listening again.
Oh, you're watching.
Reading. Reading. If anyone's going to write a transcript for this. So, yeah, thank you, and we'll see you with the next episode.
See ya.
Peace.